Kelly.
Hello and welcome to Sports Weekly India. Since we last met, there's been a lot that's changed in the world of sport. The Indian women's cricket team has whitewashed their English counterparts in an ODI series, and they've set more than one cat among the pigeons. We'll talk about that. The Indian men's team has also won a series against Australia, and yes, the world does keep turning, even without Roger Federer being actively playing tennis. So let's see how the world is doing. Joining me are RK and Ayaz Memon. Welcome to the show, gentlemen, to deep dive into this world of sport. And of course, we'll hear from Saumil Arora on everything that's happening in the world of motorsport, specifically MotoGP. But first, here's the big story. A friendly reminder to all our listeners before we begin, subscribe or follow the show on BingePod, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, JioSaavn, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll start with the big controversy coming out of the UK. Ayaz, you've seen a lot of cricket over the years. What do you think? Did Dipti Sharma do anything wrong?
I mean, look, she stayed within the rules. I think, it's a bit of a travesty of fair play. If you say that a player who's lived within the rules should be castigated, should be pilloried, should be condemned for doing what the rules say you can do. So I think, you know, this whole notion of the spirit of cricket is getting a little... I mean, nothing wrong with it, but I think what has happened is now the rules have clearly defined. In fact, this happened last week. The ICC and the MCC have kind of ratified what each other is saying and saying, look, this is how it will be, that the non-striker can't leave the return crease before the ball is delivered. And that's exactly what happened with Dean. She had to unfortunately go. It's not the best way for a batsman to be or a batter to be dismissed. And I think it got kind of accentuated this whole episode because England ran India very close. Suppose India were winning by a margin of 80, 90 runs, the brouhaha would have been far lesser. But because the match was also close, I think it's become, a talking point across the cricket globe. But having said that, I think the position one has to take, because otherwise it opens up a can of worms. Then every law can be flouted or not adhered to or disregarded. So I think more and more now you find people don't walk, batsmen don't walk till the umpire gives them out. In the spirit of cricket, you would have walked. In the old days, people did walk. Some did, some didn't. Now people wait for the umpire's decision, which I think is fair dinkum. A lot of things have happened. Technology is introduced, ultra edge. Many things which players assumed were in the spirit of the game are now dependent on technology to take the game forward. So I think we have to kind of let it be there rather than prolong or, get into a more protracted discussion on whether she was right or wrong. I think she was within the laws. That's good enough for me.
Absolutely. And RK, what do you make of this hue and cry by all of the English men's cricketers? I haven't heard too much from the women cricketers. I don't know if they've had much to say about this, but the English men's team seems to be up in arms.
To be very, very honest, I really do not understand what the fuss is all about. To begin with, it is within the rules of the game, and therefore it is a dismissal, period. Every time this comes up, I don't understand what the hue and cry is all about. In fact, I think not too long back, a few years back, I think there was a series between England and New Zealand where one of the bowlers of the English cricket team collided with the New Zealand batter. And what happened after that was the English fielding team recovered, threw the ball to, I think it was Ian Bell, who threw the ball to the keeper and he took out the bails. Now, Mark Benson was the umpire at that point in time. He went and asked Paul Collingwood, who was the captain of the English cricket team, whether he would want to revoke the appeal because technically it wasn't within the spirit of the game, if you want to use that phrase. But he said no, and it all stood. The reason why I'm talking about this incident is if there is a team, if there is a set of cricketers that simply cannot cry about it, it has got to be the English cricketers. And they are the first one to make a huge hue and cry about everything that transpired. Honestly, it's a part of the rule. Let's get on with the game. Don't want to even engage with anybody saying it's not within the spirit of the game. Define spirit of the game. Define rules within the spirit of the game, please. There are laws that are there to be followed. Follow the laws. That's it. Move on.
I completely agree. And this is precisely my take also. And I think the contrast you're seeing, say, from a lot of the former or present English men's players talking about this more volubly than perhaps the women cricketers who perhaps, those who were involved in this match, they haven't said much. Though in the next match, which Dean played, she went and kind of pretended to run out the non-striker, which I thought was good fun. I mean, she was making a point and fair enough. But I think where the men's cricketers are concerned, Jimmy Anderson, Stuart Broad especially, who doesn't have a great record as possessing a very sporting demeanor, a demeanor on the field of play, and Sam Billings, who I thought was a strange addition to this group. But I think there is a feeling within England, this is my perception, I may be wrong, is that we are the last bastion of protecting what was old world virtue, which came from us, and therefore we are the only ones remaining. The West Indies don't regard it any longer. The Aussies never did, where England and Australia were concerned. In fact, India did to a large extent. If you remember that Gundappa Vishwanath recalled Bob Taylor in the Jubilee Test in 79-80. You know, the umpire had given him out, but he called him back, and then India went and lost the match because Bob Taylor and Ian Botham had a massive partnership. But I think this thing of, oh, we are the upholders of great tradition, others are not, is a little ill-founded, because ultimately, whether you are or not, you still have to play within the rules of the game. And let's stick to that.
Absolutely. I think it's almost as if they feel they can do and uphold the laws, but when they're subjected to it, it's unfair and spirit overtakes law. RK, just to add to that, I think the offending bowler in the incident you described was Ryan Sidebottom. And I think we could almost call such incidents as, you know, being sidebottomed. Maybe that's a phrase we've got to start pushing out if they're sticking to Munkaded. But I guess this series was also Julan Goswami's farewell. I mean, what a cricketer she's been for India over the years. She's been there for as long as one can remember. Do you really see anyone filling her boots? How does the larder, so to speak, look after her?
Not easy. I mean, Renuka Singh has been doing exceptionally in England in the Commonwealth Games and also in the three match series that India won, made a clean sweep actually. So actually what one sees is that the Indian team, women's team, is performing very well, very impressively. It's been a graph which is going upwards, and despite losing two stalwarts, Mithali Raj some time back and now Julan Goswami, she's had a, you know, farewell match, but her contribution is enormous. Look, whether there will be another one like her or not, difficult to say. In fact, what I think is that players and skills get better. They get better temperamentally also, mentally tougher. The game evolves. And so then players live in the ethos of their, you know, of their times. So I would say that, you know, it's not a situation that, oh, if Julan Goswami is gone, our prospects will completely nosedive. That's not going to be the case, I think. There are lots. Ultimately, the talent pool for the women's game is expanding also. Even 2 years back, we didn't have as many women playing cricket, and now it's getting to be bigger and better. And part of the reason is because of what Julan Goswami and Mithali Raj and some of the others have done. They've just inspired a whole host of young girls to take up the sport. And they are excelling now, which makes it much richer. The Indian cricket scene is much richer, even in the women's section.
Absolutely. Well, we are wishing Julan a very, very happy retirement, and we hope to see her staying involved with the game. Moving on to India versus Australia, and what a great series that finally turned out to be. Despite Australia, I think, dominating for a fair part of it, India found ways to win. RK, is this India showing signs of settling down, or are we as fans relaxing a little prematurely?
Well, I think from where it started for Rohit Sharma in this particular series to how it ended and where it ended, I think he's got enough reasons to be pleased. The reason why I'm saying that is the batting is looking fairly settled. Because in game number one, you scored over 200 runs. It's another matter that you weren't able to defend it. I'll come to that in just a moment. In game number two, in a truncated game of 8 overs each side, you won a game by scoring close to 12 runs an over with 3 balls to spare. And in game number three, again, you did all right by chasing a fairly big total. That was about 186, 187. So that tells me that the batting is sorted. The brand of cricket that we talk about when it comes to batting, there's been a sense of consistency in that. Now, the biggest positive is also for me the emergence of an Akshar Patel. Look, the reason why I say emergence is because his record over the last year or year and a half isn't all that bad. But because you had somebody like Ravindra Jadeja, it has always been under the radar. And he's been doing the job very, very quietly. So batting like for like, I'm not so sure. But bowling, I seriously think Akshar Patel in T20 is better than a Ravindra Jadeja. Fielding, obviously Jadeja is a better fielder. But I think it's still a very good positive for Team India. Bowling, let's put it into some kind of context. Bumrah and Harshal Patel are coming back after an injury. And therefore, I would still want to see them in South Africa, or rather in that series against South Africa, and understand how they are. But I think overall, I think we've got reasonably enough reasons to be pleased about everything that has gone on. And I think the team that started in the final T20 International will, I guess, be your starting 11 for that game against Pakistan. Maybe an Arshdeep instead of a Harshal, if his form doesn't improve, I do not know. But I think this is broadly what it is. We have settled down on the debate between Dinesh Karthik and Pant. It looks like with Akshar doing all right, you've got a left-hander there. And therefore, Dinesh Karthik scores over Rishabh Pant. And those two shots in the second T20 International left a huge impact. Dinesh Karthik scoring a 6 and a 4 of Daniel Sams. I think we are fairly settled there.
That's actually, as a fan, a great thing to hear. Ayaz, the bowling, like RK also said, there is still a fair bit of work to be done. I mean, Harshal Patel remains a worry, and Bhuvi still seems to be fairly out of sorts.
Yeah, I mean, look, Bhuvi went for runs in, you know, two matches and went for plenty towards the end. So that could be a bit of a concern. But, you know, I would look at what he's done over the last 5-6 months rather than just the last 5 days. You know, and you'll find that he's been consistently picking up wickets in his first spell. That is so important. If you have Bhuvneshwar in your team, you shouldn't be really looking at how many runs he contains towards the end. It should be how many wickets he takes up front, because then he gives you the position or a situational advantage which the other bowlers can exploit. So I would look at how well he's bowled in his first spell rather than his last. Not that the last spell is not important, but you've got Arshdeep, you've got Bumrah, you've got, you know, some of the others who can, that's their speciality. Bhuvneshwar's speciality is up front. So I would say, I think also that, you know, the team we saw play the third match is the likely team which will start in Pakistan. But I have one compunction which I must raise here, is that it's difficult for me to fathom a team which will be without Rishabh Pant taking the field or playing 11. So, no, you know, not to take away anything from Dinesh Karthik, the way he's been playing, and just he customized himself as a finisher and somebody who's kind of targeted this World Cup to come and play this, and he's made a huge success of it. But Rishabh Pant still, I think, has that X factor which not many players in the Indian team have. So I would, you know, it's going to be a tough call when you go there. And remember, he's got huge success in Australia. So he'll carry that confidence with him when he goes to play in Australia. And there's he's a younger man. Not that Dinesh is in any way behind in terms of fitness or in confidence. But I think that for me, that's really the toughest call that the team management has to still make.
Absolutely. Moving away for a second from India, I find it very surprising that Cameron Green is not a part of Australia's squad for the World T20. I mean, he was the X-factor, as you called Rishabh Pant, for India. He was the X-factor for Australia, and he was scary. You know, just to imagine him opening for Australia in some of those World Cup matches, it can be very, very scary for a lot of opposition. What do you make of that, RK?
Yeah, it was scary. It was fantastic to see Cameron Green bat. I think if you're a fan of the Australian cricket team, you've got a lot of things to be excited about. But I think the reason why Cameron Green was also a part of this particular squad is because David Warner was rested. And also the recent success that he had in the One Day International Series against New Zealand. I think there was this partnership between him and Alex Carey, where they took Australia over the line in the Chappell Hadley Series, which is precisely the reason why he has been a part of the squad. And this is the first ever time, this series was the first ever time that he actually opened in T20 International. He's fairly young, is Cameron Green. He's still got a long way to go. Getting back to the question of it being surprising, look, where can he fit in is the obvious question that you need to ask. Is it going to be at the top of the order? If yes, you've got to actually replace a David Warner out there to replace at the top of the order, because David Warner is going to open with Aaron Finch. Or you look around and say, Stephen Smith is not a part of my plans at all. At this stage, are you willing to do that? Is the question that you will have to ask the Australian selectors. Because Stephen Smith, honestly, all things aside, is one of the best to have played the game. But I guess it's more in Test cricket and One Day International cricket. With respect to T20 cricket and how the game has evolved, if you look at the strike rates of Stephen Smith, he plays normally 4 and below as Mr. Fix-It. A strike rate around those positions over the last 1 year has dipped from about 125, which itself is not the best strike rate, coming in at about 4-7, to about 107. So does Stephen Smith merit a side in that setup? And what happens when the likes of Stoinis or a Mitchell Marsh and the others come in? Maybe the other way of looking at it, if I have some time, is if Mitchell Marsh's injury is serious, if he's breaking down, then maybe are you willing to bring in a Cameron Green into the setup? Because he can again hit big, is Cameron Green, and he gives you that seam bowling option as well. So that position could be up for grabs if Mitchell Marsh doesn't recover in time or if he has got a serious injury. Otherwise, are you willing to say, Stephen Smith, step aside, let me bring in this youngster? Not sure.
That would be a very, very big call. And more reasons than one. I mean, it's not just a team composition, but it's Steve Smith. I mean, is it blasphemous to say it's almost as if saying we want to drop Virat Kohli in favor of a younger batsman?
I mean, it would be in that sense. Yes, Steve Smith and Virat Kohli, you would say that they are of equal stature. But Virat had a far more impressive record in all, you know, when you look at all three formats. In white ball cricket, Virat was, I think, superior to Steve Smith. In test cricket, you could say that Steve Smith was unique in so many ways. Cameron Green is an interesting dilemma for the Aussies now. He's in very rich form. He's a young fellow who's now looking. He was touted and positioned as a red ball specialist. He's taken a little while to come to terms with that kind of job responsibility. But his graph is going, you know, skywards rapidly. The white ball matches that he's played in the last couple of months just show you how good he has become. And these matches in India against an Indian team, which is a very strong team on Indian pitches, he just gives you that huge advantage if he fires, because he's a guy who can hit 180, 85 yards, 90 yards consistently. And him and David Warner opening the innings actually is quite a frightening prospect. If you ask me, the most vulnerable kind of link in the Australian team is actually Aaron Finch, who's not had much to do he's done a wonderful job as a captain and he led them to victory in the last World Cup, but he's not been in great form. So whether it's Steve Smith, I don't think Aaron Finch will be obviously replaced, but Steve Smith could be, somebody they are looking at watching very closely to see what can be done. I don't know how they can manage, if they can put him into the squad in some way, even if it's like a standby, you contrive a situation, he comes in place of Sean Abbott or somebody like that. Yes, fine. Then when you have him in the 15, you can play around with the combination.
Absolutely. RK, the India-Australia series, just to quickly wrap that up, what do you think is the biggest takeaway for India? The batting, the bowling, or just the fact that we won?
Obviously, the confidence is boosted by a victory. But I think if I've got to still narrow it down and pick up one big takeaway, it is Akshar Patel's performance. I think you effectively have got two all-rounders. One is Hardik Pandya, who's also going to be rested for that South Africa series. The other all-rounder was Ravindra Jadeja. The minute he was out, the balance went for a bit of a toss, or so it seemed. And therefore, it was imperative for Akshar Patel to step up, and he did all right. So to me, he's the biggest takeaway from this particular series. And let's not forget, in the third T20 International, he bowled three overs in the power play, which means that he's also lending support to the captain in terms of distributing a Jasprit Bumrah's over a bit better. So I think that, to me, is your biggest takeaway. Batting has been very, very good, as I said just a while back.
Awesome. To wrap up the whole cricket scene right now, I think India A is also playing against New Zealand A, and they've won the series down under. Ayaz, is this a way for BCCI to just have some high-quality standbys in match-fit mode in case they're needed to be called upon in Australia? They're playing in not exactly same, but somewhat similar conditions.
I think you've got so many players available now that you have to keep them engaged. If these guys were not playing India A or some other competitive and a decent level of competitive matches, then, you know, people can get rusty, there's boredom which sets in, frustration. I think it's a good way to keep young players or emerging players engaged against good quality opposition. The New Zealand A team is not a bad team at all.
RK, there's an exciting T20 series also going on in Pakistan. And it's tied 2-2 at the moment. There's three matches to go. And these are two teams that are heavily billed for the World T20. I think this is great preparation for both of them. What do you make of these teams and how do you see this series playing out?
When I looked at England and Pakistan at the top, really, before the series began, I was intrigued by the whole setup. The reason why I say that is because these are two teams that follow a completely different style of approach when it comes to T20 cricket. England is just goes bang, bang, bang from ball number one, as opposed to, say, a Pakistan, which is happy to let a Babar Azam settle in, Mohammad Rizwan doing the bulk of the scoring over the first few overs, and if possible, stay around for the entire period. and they've got a very, very reliable seam attack to go along with it, which is why I think the previous T20 International, which happened in Karachi, where Harris Rauf bowled his 19th over and did splendidly well, was of huge significance. So it almost tells me that if Pakistan are going to end up with 166 to 170, which by no means is a great T20 score in accordance with the modern version of T20, they still have got a very, very good bowling unit to do the job. And I think that is where this series gets a lot more intriguing. You had that odd game where Mohammad Rizwan and Babar Azam did the job in its entirety. Babar scoring 100, a much deserved one, great strike rate and all that. But that is not going to happen every time. The bowlers are going to do the job probably for Pakistan more often than not, in the event of Pakistan only scoring about that 165 to 175, which seems to be par for the course for the Pakistan cricket team. And that is why this game or this series is a lot more fascinating.
Absolutely. Well, those are two teams to watch out for sure. Pakistan, after their recent success in the Asia Cup, are a very confident lot. And England have been with the bass ball and everything, been on top of the shorter version of the game as well. Coming back closer to home, the West Zone has won the Duleep Trophy. But that's not really the big news, is it? It's back to Ajinkya Rahane. You know, who is he as a person and what he did with the top scorer in the game, Yashasvi Jaiswal, and how he plays the game. I really want to get quick, both of you, on what you make of this incident where Rahane asked Jaiswal to leave the field of play, calm down during his confrontation with Ravi Teja. I mean, for all of us who saw that, we could see how visibly frustrated even the umpires were and how over the top Jaiswal was going, probably riding high on the wave of his own batting performance. But what does this say about Rahane as a leader? Ayaz?
Well, I think it shows that he's an affirmative personality. A lot of people think Rahane is very meek, to use to use that word very cautiously. But I think he just put his foot down. And I think this is where we discuss spirit of cricket, you know, and how it should be protected. This is the best example that you get. I mean, you are your own teammate, you are kind of admonishing, even punishing, for just letting loose verbal volleys at the opposing team, you know, sledging, if you may call it, still call it that. But I think, and to your best performer in that match, you know, he was man of the match. It's ironical that Yashasvi Jaiswal, who was man of the match, had to actually be packed off the field, spent 7 overs in the dressing room, and then he was recalled onto the pitch. I think for a youngster, this is a lesson of a lifetime, and I really admire Ajinkya Rahane for doing this. It's so easy to say, you know, we played tough and we won the match and we won the trophy. But that's not how you play if you want to protect the spirit of cricket. And I think this is a great example. This is what the English player should be talking about, in my opinion.
RK, there's also this bit of side chatter happening that Jaiswal was in the Kohli mold while Rahane wanted him to be in his mold. And I don't know if there's a right or a wrong mold to be, because there's also counter arguments that, hey, they both have won big series. They're both big performers. What do you think?
Well, to be honest, Kohli's graph is completely something else. I mean, Yashasvi Jaiswal is just about starting off, to be honest. He's had a couple of IPL seasons. Yes, he scored a double 100. And just talking about Ajinkya Rahane, the leader, I think his ability as a leader was well in display when India did exceptionally well in Australia. So there was never, ever any doubt about Ajinkya Rahane being the leader and the character that he displayed. But I think the bigger talking point to me is I was actually surprised that Yashasvi Jaiswal did what he did. Not necessarily to Ravi Teja. Look, I mean, sledging, talking, banter, it all can be a part of the game. But I'm curious to hear what Ayaz thinks about it, because here's a youngster who's had a couple of seasons ingrained with the Mumbai cricketing culture, speaking against his own captain. You know, at the end of the day, you're talking about Ajinkya Rahane from Mumbai and Yashasvi Jaiswal from Mumbai. Could it have happened before? I'm sure there would have been incidents of a player disagreeing with his captain, but so vocally, and therefore it kind of makes me ask more questions than one. Is it just the runs? Is it just the double 100? Is it just the man of the match performance in this game? Or is it about IPL or the kind of bank balance that these young cricketers have at a very, very early age, which makes them believe that they can almost get away with anything? And therefore, you obviously need the good old-timers to calm things down and take a stern decision if necessary, which is exactly what an Ajinkya Rahane did. And he did exceptionally well at the risk of playing with only 10 men on a cricketing field.
RK, I think you're right. I mean, it's not just a cricket performance thing, obviously. It's a cultural thing. You know, there's Rashesh Jaiswal, who's a very promising, talented youngster who's made a lot of runs for Mumbai. He's also made a lot of money in the IPL, as you know, at this young age. So, you know, I think there is a need for a certain kind of mellowing processes that have to be put in place, especially for young talent. This is something that Rahul Dravid has talked about, that when you're in the cricket academy or when you're a youngster inducted into the IPL, there must be mentoring about how to handle fame and the pressures of fame. This is not just about self-indulgence. It also comes from the pressure of fame. You assume that I have to be, you know, tough and challenging and confrontationist to be accepted by my peers and by people who are looking at my future roadmap. That's not really the case, or not necessarily the case. But it could also be that there's so much influence in the IPL where you meet all kinds of players, and some will tell you, you know, this is the way to play. Another will tell you, this is the way to play. And that's where the captain becomes so important, because the captain decides, in that sense, the culture of the team he's leading. The same team may be led by two different people in two different ways. So Ajinkya Rahane has shown his character, his purpose of the way he plays. And I think he mentioned it also. He says, there is a way that I know how to play cricket. And that's the way that Yashasvi Jaiswal has to do. He has to toe the line till, you know, he finds another captain who accepts that what he did was, you know, palatable. But I think overall, the protection of the spirit of cricket comes from affirmative action, and which is what Ajinkya Rahane must be lauded for. He didn't let success of his team, or his, in this case, the star player, override his own sentiment about what cricket means for him and what the spirit of cricket means for the game.
Absolutely. Well, I think all agreed that this is the real spirit of the game, and not following only, you know, what others want us to follow. Moving on to tennis, and here we are, life without Roger Federer. And I know I've said this a few times. So I think I've made it apparent that I'm a Federer fan. But anyway, the Laver Cup is finally done. Team World has won it for the first time in five times of asking. At one point, this tournament really was about to become a big, fat Roger Federer farewell weep fest. Then Nadal went home. I think he just showed up for that one farewell match, didn't he? I also thought it very strange that there's no Carlos Alcaraz in this. I don't know if it was a conflict, a scheduling conflict, or what the reason was. RK, who do you think stood out the most for you? Were you able to catch a lot of the games?
A fair extent, but I think it was all about Federer. I still believe it was all about Federer. I mean, let's be honest about it. Where if you ask anybody about what you remember the most about this Laver Cup, people are going to turn around and say, look, it's the last time that we've got to witness Roger Federer. I mean, I think in the way, would Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal have been the ideal doubles partners if, you know, Roger Federer had been playing or had not announced a retirement? Probably not. And therefore, it was fairly obvious that, look, Roger Federer did say that he had informed Nadal about his retirement 10 days before his official announcement. And he asked him whether he could pair up for the doubles. He, in fact, went and asked Bjorn Borg, who was the captain of the side, if he's okay with him pairing up with Rafa Nadal to play doubles, because he wanted to do just doubles because his body wasn't doing justice. Look, all things being equal, probably Roger Federer shouldn't have even played the Laver Cup. Let's be honest about it, because his knees weren't great, his back wasn't great. So every one of us was expecting him to come back stronger at the start of the next season in the Australian Open. But the fact that he retired, obviously, it was all about Roger Federer. So it was almost as if the world, with the top players around, with the O2 Arena, giving a farewell to one of the greatest to have played, not just tennis, one of the greatest to have played sport. So for me, Laver Cup will be, or this Laver Cup will be all about Roger Federer. Forget about Andy Murray coming at the back of his hip replacement, doing all right, or Djokovic doing all right. But I think it's all about Roger Federer for me.
Absolutely. And do you, Ayaz, think that the tournaments like the Laver Cup, which brings a lot of players together, there's a bit of a team structure to it, slightly different format. Is this the future? Because there's been a lot of talk that Grand Slams and the whole tennis calendar is just sort of repetitive, competition is reducing. What do you think?
It's a great thing for eyeballs. I mean, you're catering to fans and television audiences, and you've got you know, terrific stars playing. I think if as long as the stars are available, I mean, mega stars, not the stars, like Federer and Nadal and Djokovic and Andy Murray, and there is an audience or eyeballs for it, yes, I think the temptation or the need to cater to that audience, and which is easily then supported by, you know, the monetization that is possible. But if there's a drought of rich talent and it's not as, you know, there are not so many stars around, which can happen. Sometimes there's a wave which comes and you find, you know, there are many competitors and many claimants and, you know, nobody who settles in. You've had these guys for the last decade or more been dominating the tennis scene. So it just adds flavor and value. So, I mean, I think this could be very dependent on how the situation is at a particular point in time in tennis or a particular era, rather than saying, but does this work forever? Maybe not, but maybe, you know, maybe it does. We'll have to wait and see.
Absolutely. Well, for me, Francis Tiafoe, Felix Auger-Aliassime, Casper Ruud, and the missing Carlos Alcaraz, those are the four players that excite me the most for 2023. Let's hope that they can come good on that. Moving on, our most reliable motorsport source, Saumil Arora, has informed us that India has just signed up a long-term deal to host MotoGP at the Budh International Circuit, and it will be the first time that India hosts a MotoGP race. The target is to have the race next year, 2023. What does this mean for the sport in India? With that and more, here's Saumil Arora.
It seems too good to be true. MotoGP will be coming to India and could be potentially here as soon as next year as well. And I'm already getting jitters because for us Indian motorsport fans, it's a big, big deal. The last time we had a major world championship event in India was all the way back in 2013 when Formula One had their last race over here. But since then, it's been barren. It's been dry. We've had a few track days here and there at the Budh International Circuit, a couple of national racing championships here and there that take part every year, but nothing of the same scale or of the same size of something like Formula One or MotoGP. And the fact that MotoGP is coming to India for the first time in its history makes it even more special. Because remember, MotoGP sees India as one of its biggest markets. We've got millions of fans here in India. We've got millions of bikes here in India. For companies like Yamaha, Honda, for that matter, even Ducati, who's also witnessing a high demand in India. This is the primary place to advertise their bikes, and it's going to be outstanding. It's going to take part of the Budh International Circuit, the place where we had the Formula One races in the past as well. But it's under slightly mysterious circumstances, because the company that's actually signed an MOU with MotoGP is called Fair Street Sports, and I'm pretty sure they didn't even exist until a month ago. They've got no information about who they are, what they do, who are their board of directors, who's leading the operation, what is their modus operandi, nothing. They've just randomly popped out of the blue, signed an agreement with MotoGP, got the Uttar Pradesh government involved and said, right, we are going to get this done, and signed a deal for 7 long years. I don't know, it almost seems too good to be true, but let's wait and watch. If it goes ahead, this is going to be such an exciting event and such a big win for Indian motorsport. When you also consider the fact that Formula E is also going to come to Hyderabad next year. So it's all happening. All the good things are coming together for motorsport in India. And I can't wait to see how this pans out. Just how do they redevelop the Budh circuit and how exciting the race is going to be there, because MotoGP always delivers a cracker. Oh my God, I can't wait.
Thanks for that, Saumil. We'll be watching very closely on how the races pan out, and well, hopefully we'll all be able to get there. That's it from us for this episode of Sports Weekly India. Coming up on the next episode, a lot of action from the India versus South Africa series. The Premier League is back and we've got the Manchester Derby to look forward to. I know where RK's money sits. And we've also got the Formula One race coming back after a 3-week break. We're heading to Singapore. So if you're in Singapore watching any of these games, send us a voice note, send us a picture. We'll be happy to share that. And I just want to needle a little bit here. And I think RK Manchester is going to be blue. Manchester is going to be red. What do you think?
If you ask me what I think, Manchester will always be red. It's as simple as that.
Well, we'll find out about that next week. Be sure to join us. Remember to subscribe and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much, Ayaz. Thank you so much, RK. Pleasure to have you on the show. Until next time, goodbye.
There's a lot of sporting action around and you don't want to miss out. Listen to us free on Binge Pods or subscribe or follow us wherever you get your podcasts.